I'm Kurt Loder with MTV News. Def Leppard guitarist Steve Clark died in his sleep at his home in London on Monday night at the age of 30. It was a particularly sad loss for a band that's had more than its share of heartaches over the last 13 years. Here's the story.
Like many another rock star before him, Steve Clark was an ordinary working-class kid whose life was changed by rock and roll.
You know, I played classic guitar for about a couple of years, and then one day I heard Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin playing this riff for the song How Many More Times, and that was it. I just threw the classic guitar through the window. I said, that's what I do. I play rock music.
Punk rock was all the rage in England in the late 70s, but Clark was a hard rocker, and he found a group of kindred teenage spirits in a fledgling band called Def Leppard. They debuted with an EP in 1979, and by 1983 were going multi-platinum with their third album, Pyromania, which featured one of Clark's best riffs on the hit single, Photograph. Fortune beckoned, but Clark and his Def Leppard mates were determined not to let success turn them into heavy metal cartoons.
Whatever it feels right, and we'll be the first people to know, you know, when it doesn't. It'll become obvious at some point. It'd be like getting on the stage now wearing spandex. No.
Along with all the success, Def Leppard had plenty of problems. They'd already lost founding guitarist Pete Willis, and then, as work on the group's fourth LP got underway, drummer Rick Allen lost his left arm in a car crash. The album seemed to be on permanent hold, but Allen bounded back into the drum seat with the aid of computer drum technology, and when Hysteria was finally released, it took Def Leppard all the way to the top of the U.S. charts. But all the fame and fortune in the world couldn't help Steve Clark kick his drinking problem, and in the end, Def Leppard's remarkable success couldn't save his life either.
Def Leppard guitarist Steve Clark dead at 30.
And this is Stephen Clark on the guitar.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and it's time for episode number 5 in my series on Def Leppard, and we've made it to their, what year did this come out, 1992?
92.
Yeah, their fifth album, Adrenalize, and my special guest for this episode is Eric Miller from the Pods and Sods Network. Hey, Eric, how's it going?
Hey, BJ, good. How you doing, man?
I'm good. You know, I don't know how much listening to this album brightened either of our days, but
I have mixed feelings on the record.
Yeah, so we were just before we started recording, we were just talking about how I kind of felt like adding a disclaimer at the beginning of this episode and talking about how I was thinking about when I did the Hysteria episode with Joey Haney, and I tried to be funny sometimes and crack some jokes about certain songs that I don't like. And then I felt like I started to think, like, what if Joe Elliott, not that this would ever happen, but what if Joe Elliott or somebody listened to this episode and I'm just being so flippant and smug about some song that he put so much time and effort into. And I have so much respect for these guys as artists and everything. So then I thought maybe I should say something, especially since considering the album we're going to talk about now, maybe I should say something about that, just about my mix. I mean, you know, it's all right to have an opinion on a song and maybe explain why you don't like a song, but I could totally see the guys in Def Leppard being like, you know, fuck off. Who cares what you think? And
right.
Yeah, and I would never want to be mean to be disrespectful to those guys. And, you know, like I think we were kind of talking about, I mean, I respect anybody who, you know, tries to do something creative. And I mean, I respect that. I have a lot of respect for anybody who pursues a creative endeavor of any kind. So I don't mean to be just dismissive or smug or anything like that. I'm trying to be funny sometimes, and just, you know, yeah, I have an opinion on the songs. So it's just my own personal opinion based on my taste or whatever.
Of course. And that's why people listen to your show, because they like your tastes and they appreciate your humor and occasional smugness. So, first off, I want to thank you for making me the reluctant guest on this particular album. It was kind of like every other album was picked in gym class, and this was the last one. So I was like, I'll do this one.
Yeah, thanks for taking one for the team.
I'm not I'm a reasonable Def Leppard fan. I'm not an over the top kind of guy, and you know, I probably bought this the day it came out, and I saw them on this tour with Craig, my Pods and Sods co-host in Philly, and they kind of lost me after this, and I think this record is a bit of why they lost me, which I think is probably common in a Def Leppard world.
Yeah, I also bought this record the day it came out, I'm sure, but yeah.
You know what it was? I think it's I actually very much enjoy Hysteria. To me, that one, I don't know why people dump on it so much these days. It's one of those things that has come around to being uncool in some circles, but I don't sort of buy into that. I don't really agree with that. I still love Hysteria, and you know, Pour Some Sugar on Me obviously is ubiquitous, but you know, once you sort of cut through the fact that you hear it on the daily, I can still appreciate Pour Some Sugar on Me and a lot of those songs, you know, Women Rockin', I love all that shit. So, but I think the stuff that people don't like about that in terms of production, the Mutt Lang, and, you know, as, again, Craig, my co-host, always does the, hey, right, all that.
Yeah.
All that stuff that came out of Hysteria, like Adrenalize just takes that to, you know, like it's a caricature of Hysteria in some ways, right? And, you know, all those things that people probably hook into to criticize is just tenfold on Adrenalize versus Hysteria. So I think it was a step further in maybe not the coolest direction.
Yeah, I'm such a huge fan of the first three albums that, you know, I remember when Hysteria came out, I was already a fan by then. And yeah, I was really disappointed with Hysteria. And they're, you know, I mean, like I talked about with Joey, Animal and the song Hysteria, I absolutely love those songs and listen to those all the time. But most of the rest of the record, I just never really listened to it. There's a couple of songs I really dislike. Most of it, I'm just kind of ambivalent about some of it. It seems like almost a completely different band from, you know, what they did before Hysteria.
Right.
Which, you know, not doesn't necessarily make it bad just because it sounds different, but I'm a way bigger fan of Def Leppard before Hysteria than Hysteria itself, you know?
Yeah. And like I said, I think this takes all those things that turn you off from original Def Leppard to Hysteria era Def Leppard and pushes them even further, right? The teeth have been ground down even further by the time you get to Adrenalize.
Yeah, it's like, if I would rank the songs on Hysteria, the songs that would be like in the middle are way better than pretty much anything on Adrenalize, which is the problem, I guess. The Hysteria tour ended on October 27th, 1988, and right away in November of 88, they already started working on the next album. In fact, I think I played the demo of Tonight at the end of the Hysteria episode. I think that was recorded in November of 88, if I remember right. So they got right to work on the record, because the idea was it took so long for Hysteria, they didn't want the same thing to happen. And then the same thing happened. I think it was 4 years and 8 months between Pyromania and Hysteria, and it was 4 years and 7 months between Hysteria and Adrenalize. So pretty much the exact same amount of time. But of course, just like with Hysteria, events conspired against them. Their last performance with Steve Clark was on September 6th of 1989 at the MTV Video Music Awards, and I very much remember watching that at the time because they played Tear It Down, and it was awesome.
Yeah, I remember that.
Here they are with Tear It Down, Def Leppard!
Yeah.
So that was December of 1989. Steve Clark somehow found himself in a psychiatric hospital in Minnesota because he was found unconscious, I guess, like on the sidewalk with a blood alcohol level of 0.59, which 0.41 is what killed John Bonham. So, and apparently 0.3 blood alcohol level is considered coma inducing, which is why Steve Clark apparently quipped that he survived a double coma. As so, Joe Elliott, Phil Collin, and Mutt Lang all flew to Minneapolis to get Steve out of the psychiatric hospital and into rehab or something like that. I'm not sure exactly how it went, but I imagine... I talked with Julian Gill on the High and Dry episode about how no one has really written a great Def Leppard biography, and you've got stories like this. It could be a whole chapter about the Steve Clark meltdown in Minneapolis, and just imagining Joe Elliott and Mutt Lang flying to Minneapolis to get Steve Clark out of the psychiatric hospital. The whole thing is fascinating. It would make such a great book and a great movie, you know? I mean, what a story for this band, and I can't believe there's not, you know, there's such an amazing book in this band's story, but... Of course, a lot of the chapters would be pretty depressing, I guess.
Right. Yeah, maybe they just haven't focused on... They just try to look forward in some ways. Who knows?
Yeah.
But that's kind of a funny visual is, you know, 89, Joe Elliott with the long blonde hair and the jeans with the holes in them, like, at the front desk. We're here to see our friend Steve.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And what was Steve Clark doing in Minneapolis? Well, obviously what he was doing was drinking, but it's just, that's such an odd location for this to have gone down. But so between 89 and 90, Steve Clark ended up in rehab 6 different times.
Wow.
And at that point, the band set everything aside. They took a sabbatical, and I guess they just hoped that he would survive and make it through, and of course he didn't. January 8th, 1991 is when he died in his London home. The cause of death, of course, being an excess of alcohol combined with antidepressants and painkillers.
He was only 30 years old, right?
So yeah, imagine 30.
Imagine where you were at 30, right? That's crazy. You know, I wonder, like, that had to be, like, to wrestle with something like that and contend with it. You know, you have your career, you know, like the guys in Alice in Chains having to, you know, sort of put their careers on hold a bit, you know, while Lane dealt with his things and Stone Temple Pilots and all these bands. When you have one member and it's a key member and he's your friend, he's your brother, right, he's your co-writer, all those things, like having to put everything on hold while they deal with their demons or whatever has to be challenging, man, because you know, on one hand, you want to be loyal, right, and you want to continue the success you've been having, right? Not just financially, but creatively, and the family you've created with your band. But then on the other hand, it's like, you know, how much can you sacrifice your own journey for somebody else's dark side? Do you know what I mean? So, boy, that had to be... Like, I bet you those were some long years for everybody involved.
Yeah, you have to really feel for the other guys in the band, and... I've never really been in that situation where someone I was close to, where, you know, you want to save them, but there's really no way to save them. You know,
right.
Obviously they tried to help him, but there's only so much they can do to stop him from, I mean, yeah, he's 30 years old and he's dead. That's insane. And just for no reason, he's gone. Yeah. So that must be such a horrible situation to be in for those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had situations like that with, you know, dealing with Craig's addiction to headbands, right?
Yeah.
Not quite the same.
Yeah. Well, he goes to bed with those things on, and they, you know, they could, like, work their way down to his throat and choke him to death at night or something.
A real safety hazard. I'm throwing this in there just to see if he'll listen. Like, if he catches this, then we'll know he listens.
Well, if you tie those things too tight, they can cause brain damage, which I think is evident from your show. But anyways,
so So regarding Steve, I don't think he played at all on anything on this album.
No, he did not. He played on that version of Tonight that I played at the end of the last episode, but, you know, they redid it. Yeah, he's a co-writer on 6 of the 10 songs, but there's no Steve Clark guitar on this album. Yeah, so basically they made Adrenalize as a 4-piece band, and they didn't even really start looking for a replacement for Steve Clark until the album was almost finished, which I'm guessing the idea was a new member would have just complicated things further, and they needed to get the album done. So they must have figured, let's just get the album done before we start diving into this, trying to find a new member, you know?
Right.
So when they started auditioning people in 1992, apparently two of the people they were looking at were John Sykes and Jake E. Lee, which is pretty interesting. But
I saw Gary Hoey's name in that mix also, which I didn't know.
Oh, really? Yeah, I didn't see that. When did he come out with like his one song that was kind of on the radio and stuff? Was that before this or after this?
No, he was in... Shit, what was his band? The 3-piece.
Oh, yeah, he was in the band with the guy from Cats in Boots, right?
Heavy Bones.
Heavy Bones, yeah.
Might have been...
I think.
No, I think it might have been around the same time.
Okay.
Or maybe a year after it, but... yeah, and then Gary's solo stuff. It's a summer... It's got a summer theme to it. I can't remember the one that the instrumental that did good for him on radio, but
yeah,
Gary Hoey is awesome, by the way. Tons of records. He's cool. But anyway, yeah. So, who else did you see in that? Jake E. Lee would have been an interesting fit.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked though. I don't see how that would have ever worked. But. I guess they narrowed it down to two guys, this guy named Huey Lucas, which I can find no information about this guy. I Googled him, and I searched him on, like, Encyclopedia Metallum, and he didn't show up as having been in any bands that are listed on that site, which means I don't know what band he was ever in, because they have everything on there. I found one story about... It was a benefit show for a new wave of British heavy metal band. It was, like, a recent show... for one of their members who had cancer or something, and he played at that, and that's about all I could find. I don't know how he came on Def Leppard's radar at all.
Maybe a friend of a friend or something.
Yeah.
Maybe,
In Phil Collins' book, he mentions his name but doesn't say anything else about him. And then, you know, it was between him and Vivian Campbell, I guess, which I don't know how much of a competition that was. You know, I mean, Vivian Campbell was a pretty big name by them. Of course, he was in Sweet Savage, which were kind of a contemporaries of Def Leppard at the very beginning. And then through Devo, or Devo, and then through Dio, and, you know, then he had that band River Dogs, which was very different from Dio, that's for sure. So he had shown he was kind of had versatility there. Well, Phil Collins says in his book that Vivian Campbell wasn't even really a hard rock guy. He was more into, like, Crowded House. That's what Phil Collins says. So, and they probably liked that. They were probably looking more for that kind of a guy than a Jake E. Lee guy, who was going to be much more of wanting to go in probably a heavier direction than they were really headed, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you say that, because Vivian Campbell, like, his influences are, like, Thin Lizzy is, like, the big
right,
one, right?
Yeah.
Rory Gallagher, as he says, right? Or Gallagher, as we say in the States. Like, that's not Crowded House. That's, you know, you listen to his guitar playing on Dio and stuff like that. That's certainly, that's way heavier than what Def Leppard was doing, you know, on Hysteria. So, you know, I would think the opposite. Like, a guy like that, you know, and maybe this is foreshadowing for the next record, but you would think when a guy like that gets into the mix creatively, it would take him to a heavier direction, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, those two, the you know, Thin Lizzy, Rory Gallagher, that's like Irish rock royalty right there. I mean, that's like the top of the heap as far as... So, of course, he loves them, you know? Well, and Sweet Savage, they are one of the most influential bands on Metallica. So, you know, I mean, he's got quite a pedigree, Vivian Campbell. But, you know, the band he comes into has morphed into just this pop band, basically, at this point, from the record they end up making. So, There's not a lot of metal left here, right?
Right. Yeah. The album went 3 times platinum in the U.S. I don't know if you have all this info.
Yeah, that's such a tiny number, really, you know.
Right?
Yeah.
Debuted at number one because you and I went out and bought our copies on the first day.
Yeah, another weird thing is there's no top 10 single from this record. None of them cracked the top 10 from my research, which is pretty crazy, too. And I'll also, I guess, a big part of the reason it only sold 3 million. I mean, you know, the next Def Leppard album was good. I mean, 3 million was a given. I mean, it's almost like it didn't sell a single copy because, yeah, it was going to sell 3 million out of the gate. It's like, but, you know, they needed to have a hit or something to start pushing it beyond that, I guess.
True. It wasn't for lack of trying. There were a lot of singles.
Yeah. And they did, you know, they played them on MTV quite a bit, but...
I think maybe the scene was changing at this point, too, you know?
Well, yeah, it was. Well, yeah, what I read is that when Adrenalize debuted at number one, the album it replaced at number one was Nevermind. So right. that shows you where they were at when they were coming out with this record. Yeah, so it finally came out on March 30th, 1992. And yeah, like I said, by my calculations, that's 4 years and 7 months after Hysteria. Hysteria was a famously long album. You know, 12 songs, 62 minutes. Adrenalize is 10 songs, which I always say it's 9 songs because, of course, Tear It Down was already released as a B-side from Hysteria, so... You know, really, we have 9 new songs, which is pretty sad. But also considering, you know, the uphill battle they had making the album, I guess. I mean, it's such a short record, especially considering this is the follow-up to Hysteria.
Right.
And my overall opinion of Adrenalize is it's a pretty terrible album, in my opinion.
You know what? You know how I would summarize this record is, in doing research for this episode, it kind of followed the same life cycle that it followed for me on its release, right? So when it came out, you know, I'm a fan. I'm like, I'll go pick it up the day it came out, right? And listen to it probably for a couple months, you know, in semi-rotation and didn't mind it, right? There's nothing on here that I thought was, you know, atrocious. I don't know how to say it, but it didn't hold up for me. You know, it pretty quickly dropped out of rotation and to never return until we talked about doing this episode. And then I picked it up again, like, oh yeah, this is a record I used to know and like, kind of. So I picked it up and listened to it in heavy rotation as I was preparing for this episode. And now I'm like, I can't wait to not listen to it again. Like, it kind of kind of followed the same cycle. You know, I listened to the songs, and production aside, I think production is one of the big critiques, right? And the direction they're going in terms of, like, poppiness and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't know where I'm going with that. It is what it is, and those things, like I said, it just doesn't have teeth and doesn't have staying power. But I can't necessarily point to one thing. Like, the songs aren't atrocious, you know, the production doesn't bother me. I kind of like this kind of production sometimes, I'm not gonna lie, but yeah, it just doesn't all coagulate in a sustainable way for me, if that makes any sense. Probably after this recording, I probably won't listen to this again until 20 years from now when someone else asks me to do a podcast about Adrenalize, and I'm like, oh yeah, that record, I dig it, and then I'll check it, you know, and it'll go through the same pattern again.
Yeah, there's one song on this record that I still listen to, but I wouldn't really ever care about listening to anything else on it besides
right.
the one song. But yeah, you were talking about the production, and that's one interesting thing is it ended up being produced by Mike Shipley, and Mutt Lange is only listed as executive producer, and also he's a co-writer on every song except Tear It Down.
What does executive producer on an album mean? Like,
I don't know. I mean, you know, he's listed as a co-writer on every single, all the new songs. Maybe if you're listed as a co-writer on every song, that right there qualifies you as executive producer. I don't know. I mean, he was busy producing Waking Up the Neighbors for Bryan Adams at this point, which in my opinion, is a way better record than Adrenalize. I actually really like that album a lot. I don't know if you are familiar with that record.
Not that one particularly, but I saw him recently in concert, and I quite enjoyed it. Bryan Adams, that is.
Yeah, you know that, like, Can't Stop This Thing We Started was the first single from that. That's a great song, and Thought I Died and Gone to Heaven. There's a really great song on that record called There Will Never Be Another Tonight. So that's a good album. I like, it's a fun record. It's kind of odd that Mutt chose to work with Bryan Adams over Def Leppard. I don't know if, you know, you sign contracts to do things a year in advance, and then Def Leppard are like, oh shit, I don't know how that worked out. Or maybe Mutt just didn't want to deal with, you know, diving headfirst into another Def Leppard record. I don't know. And since he's listed as his executive producer, like we're saying, I don't know if that means he was there sometimes, or, you know, he gave Mike Shipley advice, or, you know, I don't really know what how it went down. But it is a very different production from Hysteria. It's not as, there's not as much going on here. It's more, I guess it's a simpler sound than Hysteria for sure. Do you think so? Or I think Hysteria is kind of overproduced personally, and I wouldn't really call this record overproduced.
Yeah, I think the opposite. I didn't listen to it through that prism specifically, but I would think the opposite.
Really? Okay. I think
this one to me sounds more shiny. You know what I mean? Like everything's pushed up, and I don't know. Yeah.
I think when you listen to Hysteria, a lot of thought, probably too much thought, went into the songs and the production on Hysteria. That's what I come away with, and I don't think it seems like a ton of thought went into Adrenalize, really. It doesn't feel like as tinkered with and just, you know, obsessed over the way Hysteria does.
Gotcha. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, it was an interesting thing I heard. I was fortunate enough to interview Vivian, right? And I was doing research on, you know, so I listened to other interviews with him and things like that, and one thing he said that I thought was really interesting is, and I never really gave it any thought, you know, so Rick Allen obviously tragically lost his arm, right? So Hysteria is the first album where he's playing with his drum pads, right? And I'm sure you talked about that on the Hysteria episode, but, you know, it changes the way, you know, they can bring songs to him, you know, like he has to learn the songs. Like, it takes him a long time to learn the songs because his technique is different. It has to be different, right? So, you know, they sort of move away from probably what people appreciate on those first three albums, which is, you know, somewhat organic, jammy songs, right, to obviously more produced because it has to take longer because that's the guy they have on the drums, right? So he has to work out his drum parts. You know, you can't necessarily turn on a dime when you have him on the drums. And I forget the way Vivian, you know, I'm probably bastardizing the way he explained it, but, you know, suffice it to say, it changes the way they write and record in a profound way.
Yeah, well, I made the controversial statement on the last episode that, in my opinion, if you're a rock band and your drummer loses his arm, you need a new drummer. The controversial and insensitive statement, but that's just that's the way I see it, that you can't really play the drums properly in a rock band with one arm.
Like, I like the way that you, so at the top of this episode, you said you would apologize to Joe Elliott, but you just leave that comment lay with Rick.
Yeah, I forgot I should have apologized for that, too. But, you know, they weren't going to put Christopher Reeve in the next Superman movie either, so that's just, I don't know. It's like it's a really sad, tragic story, but when I listen to a rock band, the drummer kind of needs two arms.
Wow.
But, yeah, and so that, you know, that goes to your point, which is that, yeah, I mean, you know, that's going to change the whole dynamic of the band and the way everything is done. Yeah, to me it's unfortunate. But, you know, the ironic thing that we've already talked about on earlier episodes is that Mutt Lange already had him programming electronic drums on Pyromania. So
right.
Even before the accident, Mutt Lange was already pulling him in that direction anyways. But yes, no disrespect meant to Rick Allen. I just think that that's the harsh reality. You need two arms to play drums, unfortunately.
Yeah. But it changes the sound, right? So it goes from, and you know, for Hysteria, it fits in the time, but as you get to Adrenalize and, you know, as the contemporary bands are, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, it starts to stand out more. You know what I mean? Maybe that's a bit of it as well.
Yeah, if Dave Grohl lost an arm, Nirvana would have got a new drummer, right? And then he would have started the Foo Fighters earlier, but he wouldn't have been able to play guitar unless he was going to play, maybe he could Jeff Healy that shit or something.
That's fucking Dave Grohl, man. He'd figure it out, right?
Well, Jeff, no. There's somebody that plays with their foot, isn't there?
Jeff Healy was blind.
Yeah, yeah. Who is it that played with their foot? Jeff Healy just had it laying in his lap. I remember that.
Hey, you're saying all people with disabilities are the same? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
We should probably perform.
Yeah.
This is your show, so wherever you want to go.
Well, I guess we can move on to the first song. Do we want to get rocked? So the album opens with the first single, and once again, like Pour Some Sugar on Me, it was the very last song recorded for the album. Written in 2 days, recorded in 10 days. And up to this point, for me, this is the worst song the band ever recorded. I mean, there might be something worse on X, I don't know, but this is, well, I shouldn't say worse. This is my least favorite song of any song on the first 5 Def Leppard albums. To me, it's unlistenable, especially knowing what these guys are capable of. I mean, I think that's the problem I have with a song like this, is I know how talented these guys are, and I know what they're capable of, and to me, this song is just sad and depressing.
Yeah, you don't like the Bach Tchaikovsky violin with the little violin bit?
I hadn't even heard this song in, you know, 20-plus years, probably, until I listened to it when we were going to talk about it.
Right. Do you think anyone in Joe Elliott's life ever asked him to mow the lawn? seems a bit like pandering to, you know, like the rock and roll kid lazy lifestyle bit, right?
Yeah, what do they say? They say it was inspired by Bart Simpson or something.
Oh my goodness, I forgot about that. That's awful.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't use Eat My Shorts in the lyrics. Yeah, there's a bunch of lyrics that stand out to me on this. Obviously, the couple I mentioned, but there's, you know, driving with my baby to get her in the mood. Like, has that ever been good foreplay? Like, if you're in a moment with the ladies, do you, hey, let's jump in my car and go for a ride. Like, is that the move?
Especially if you're Rick Allen.
Oh, shit. He's got one arm on the wheel, and he's... you can do, right? Yeah, this, kind of like we were saying, I think this just takes all this stuff about Hysteria that probably turned people off and goes even further, right? It's, you know, it's over the top party, let's go the party route, you know, rocked is that opening bit, you know, do you want to get rocked? Like, it just,
it's embarrassing, like, yeah.
Yeah, after hearing it a couple times this go around, I can't wait to not hear it ever again. Not gonna lie. And then the video has kind of like a poorly animated Money for Nothing style kid running around. Do you remember that? They literally turn him into the things in the lyrics, right? So when he says mow the lawn, they turn the kid into a lawnmower. Do you remember that?
Not really. I'm sure I saw the video several times, but yeah.
There's actually a whole sequence where the band is playing on their, kind of in the round stage, and like all the colors are desaturated except for red. And there's a couple cool like visual effects there, and that looks cool. They could probably have done the whole video that way, but they cut in this, and maybe it was cutting edge animation in 1992, but nowadays it reminds me of that Beavis when they're watching something and it has special effects in it. He says, these effects aren't very special.
Yeah, I said it took 2 days to write this song. I can't believe it took that long, you know?
You know what, though? Like, on the flip side of it, not to just piss on it, like, it's... I don't like the chorus because it's repetitive, right? But, like, there's a couple cool little... it's fun to listen to. There are some bits in there that are neat. I think the violin thing is cool. The lyric sits, but... Yeah, overall... I'm stretching. It's not great.
So moving on to the second song, Heaven Is, I like it, but I also don't really care if I ever hear it again. It's a pleasant pop song with a decent bridge, but it's the same thing I said about Let's Get Rocked. Considering what I know these guys are capable of, you know, they really are great artists, and you know, this and there's really, really inspired stuff in their previous work, and to me this is not inspired. This song, it doesn't display a whole lot of artistry. It's just a very basic approach and execution to like a pop single, which isn't a terrible thing, but we just did an episode of Cheap Talk about the new Cheap Trick album, and we compared it a lot to other Cheap Trick albums, and then people were complaining on Facebook that we compared it too much to other albums. But I don't know how else do you judge a song? Of course I'm going to compare this song to other Def Leppard songs. I don't really know how else to... or to explain why I don't like it as much as other songs. I don't really know how else you're supposed to quantify
right.
that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny. We should just cut that whole bit that you just said and paste it into every other song on the record. You know?
Yeah.
So this was the fifth single, by the way. So Let's Get Rocked was the first, released in March 92, and Heaven Is was the fifth, released in January 93. So they kept trying with this record. I think there were seven singles total.
Wow.
But I think Heaven Is supposed to be a hooker, right? Or like just a booty call girl, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of
player. Something like that.
Yeah. You know what? Remember those... like one panel comics, it was like Happiness Is, remember those?
Yeah.
Maybe like every time I see Heaven Is, I think is that that comic strip? Are they talking about now? That was Happiness Is, but yeah it's a tight pop song, a very melodic solo, which is cool. There's, you know, if you can get past the songs and their simplicity and things like that. I mean, I'm not a musician, it's probably unfair that I use the word simplicity, but, you know, there's some cool guitar interjections, right? And this one, and the solo section, the second solo particularly, is pretty sweet. The line that always stands out to me is, well, there's two. He says, Aqualine, fine, she's a real wild one, right? So the second half of that, she's a real wild one, I always just hear that in Lou Reed voice, right? But the word aqualine, do you know what that means, aqualine?
No, I don't.
I looked it up. It's curved like a beak. So, you know, like a seabird has their beak sort of curved in such a precise way as to, I guess, collect their food or whatever. But so she's, I guess, precision, precisely fine, I think is, I don't fucking know. But I thought Aqualine, or maybe it's a brand name of some kind of, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, makeup or hairspray or something, but that's Aquanet.
Exactly. So I looked it up, but maybe that does have another meaning. But the lyrics on this album they leave you wanting a whole lot more. You know, like if you look at every song on this record, aside from one, which we'll get to, they're all just about getting laid, and they don't necessarily tell a story. It just feels like hodgepodge of bits that sound cool or rhyme. That's kind of one of my criticism. You know, I'm a huge Rat fan. I love Rats, right? But lyrically, none of those songs ever made any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Just were a bunch of words that sounded cool together, right? And I'm fine with that. And I'm kind of fine with it here, but, you know, you kind of want a little bit more from these guys, particularly the way you say it. Like, they're capable of better.
Yeah, right? That's really, I mean, more than anything, that's where my critique of this album, that's, you know, the place I'm coming from is just knowing how great they actually can be. I mean, of course I would have a different reaction to this album if it was just some new band and this was their first album. You would have a completely different perspective on it.
You wouldn't listen to it a second time.
Yeah. I still probably would have bought it the day it came out because I would have seen them in Metal Edge or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, moving on to the next song. I said Let's Get Rocked is the worst song they ever did, but I'd still rather listen to that than this song. According to Joe, it's a tongue-in-cheek song. From what I read from it, he's trying to say they're not praising their own masculinity, but rather, I guess they're trying to, like, psych themselves up or something. Yeah, I cannot listen to this. I really would rather listen to Let's Get Rocked than Make Love Like a Man. It's so sad. It just makes me sad. Oh, what they're reduced to with this song. So,
yeah, it's not great. So this was the second single in June '92.
Right.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's I even remember at the time like being kind of embarrassed. Like, what the hell is what? You know, I just didn't get it. But I do like the mashup with Shania Twain, which is "Man, I Feel Like Making Love Like a Man Tonight."
Yeah.
Right? The lyric in this that cracks me up is, you know, he says, "Don't call me Gigolo, don't call me Casanova," right? But earlier in the song, he does in Mayan, he calls himself Mr. Fun and Captain Cool. Like, he's cool with those names, but that's probably the most analysis anybody's done on the lyrics of Make Love Like a Man, right?
Did you see that Joe Elliott quote that I'm talking about where he's trying to say, we're not bragging?
Yeah. It makes sense. It's like, it's the guy on your shoulder telling you to, you know, rise to the occasion, if you will. Yeah. By the way, Gene Simmons also wrote a song called Make Love Like a Dog. Did you ever hear that one? It's a totally different position, but
yeah. So yeah. The first two singles on this record are not they're not great.
They're not off to a good start.
Pretty much the two worst songs they ever did in their entire career are the first two singles kicking off the record. So ouch. So moving on to the next song, Tonight, this was supposedly demoed back all the way in 1985, but what I read said that they Love Bites beat this song out for inclusion on Hysteria. What I wrote is that must have been a competition as to which was less bland. But so this was the first song they started working on for the follow-up to Hysteria. And,
right.
You know, I just think this song is just kind of paint by numbers and boring to me. It's just not There's just not any intensity or emotion. Just kind of, to me, it's kind of dull. Yeah, just nothing really stands out. It's not a horrible song, but it just doesn't, it's really generic sounding to me, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Def Leppard has never been, that's not a ballad band for me, you know, and like if you could argue the ballads on Hysteria, like that might be where I'm okay with them up till that point. But then Tonight, and then we get to Two Steps Behind after this and stuff, like, ooh, they really on that, right? Like, it's not a ballad. They're not a ballad band for me. So this is just kind of a reminder of that. You know, the first three songs are all upbeat, you know, kicking, making love like men into motion, etc. But when you get to Tonight, it starts up with that, ah, ooh, right? And it, like, it brings it down, but when I hear that, ah, ooh, I almost want to just fall asleep and turn it off, you know? Because I know that this is going to be, like I said, Paint by Numbers is a good way to describe it. Having said all that critical stuff, I'm still a fan, through these songs, I'm still a fan of, I guess maybe what you would call Def Leppardisms, right? Where they have, like, the mixture of the voices I like, you know, like the Tonight, like, that sounds cool, the blend of their voices, right? And sometimes how they layer the vocals, the background vocals, is nice. They throw in arrangement things that keep me from turning it off. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I think I have a note that Rick Savage actually played acoustic guitar on this version. Tonight.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, I think what I read is Phil Collins played all the guitar on the record is played by Phil Collins except that acoustic guitar on this. Yeah. Right.
And he was, for the record, he was not wearing a shirt at any point while he was doing that.
Yeah. To the next song, White Lightning, which to me this is the one attempt on the album to actually sound like the same band that made Pyromania, but it's not as good as Pyromania. It right. To me it takes too long to really go anywhere, and then the hooks aren't really that special when you get there. So I mean, it's not terrible, but it certainly doesn't inspire me to want to go listen to it. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to put White Lightning on. That's just not going to happen. I guess Phil was writing this on the Hysteria tour, and then they wrote the lyrics later, kind of as a tribute to Steve Clark. I'm sure for most Def Leppard fans, this is like their favorite song on the album, probably. But, you know, it doesn't really even stand out on the record to me. But even if it does, that's not really saying much. So,
yeah, and the lyrics, while it's nice if it's a tribute to Steve, you know, it kind of falls into the same trap where they're just not terribly inventive. They're, you know, they're overly cliche, right? Dance with the Devil, all that kind of stuff, right? It's nice.
Yeah.
if you want a tribute to Steve Clark, go listen to Song and Emotion by Tesla, because that's amazing.
Like, if you're Phil Collins and this was your tribute to your friend, I hope it achieved what he wanted it to achieve, right? Like, I hope Phil Collins listened to this, you know, and is like, all right, man. Like, that's, like, he feels like he honored his friend. So, if that's the case, then I'm all in. You know what I mean? Like, if it's successful in the guy who created it and his intention, then who am I to piss on it, right?
So, I think that's the end of side one.
And it's awesome.
Moving on to side two. This is I said there's one song in this album that I ever listened to, and that's this song, which I love this song. Stand Up, Kick Love Into Motion. Obviously, it sounds like Hysteria. It sounds like the song Hysteria. Not quite as good as the song Hysteria, but almost for me. And the copyright for the song dates back to 1987. So I think this is the first song that was written specifically for the follow-up to Hysteria. Because they already had Tonight, but that was written before Hysteria. So this was the first song that they wrote for the next album. I love the melodies. I really like the dynamics of the song. I had to be a man, you had to be a woman, bridge is great, and the killer chorus. So I love everything about this song. And I still listen to this song.
How often do you take a little love and shake it all around?
Yeah, I mean, the lyrics are terrible, but everything but the lyrics is great. So.
Yeah, Stand Up, is that like an erection? Is that what that's supposed to be? I never quite got that. I also don't like, I don't like the soft Joe Elliott vocal, right? Like the Love Bites style vocal. I got a new right now. Like the first line here. Like, that's not an area, of his voice that I really enjoy. You know, I like him, you know, when he's doing ad-libs at the end of the song and he's kind of wailing. Like, I prefer that. You know, but I understand his dynamics. You have to start off slow and all that kind of stuff, but yeah. I would agree that this is a standout on the record, you know, and pretty much for the same reason you said, it's the melody, and it's got a catchy melody and hook and a cool beat, you can dance to it, I don't know. Little by little, like a bottle of wine, my love.
So moving on to the next song, Personal Property, I tried to come up with a play on words for this song. The idea I had was combining half-assed and pulling it out of their ass, so I would say they pulled this song out of half their ass. It just seems like cheating. It's so generic and obvious. You know, it's hilarious that this song was supposed to coexist with Smells Like Teen Spirit because, you know, there are a lot of moments on this album that make me sad, like I keep saying, but this might be the saddest because it's so cookie cutter and dumb. But,
yeah.
But, you know, I guess I should go back to my disclaimer at the beginning and start apologizing for what I just said.
Right. Yeah, I don't get the intention of this song. Is it like... I don't like the chorus, personal property. Like, I don't like that affectation that he does. Like, it's trying to add a little gow to, like, a song that doesn't have a little thing, you know what I mean? Like, he's trying to add something there that it just contrived to me, and the lyrics are awful, as usual. I'm looking at it now. Blood pumping, knee trembling, spine crushing, tongue tying. Personal property, she belongs to me. By the way, you should try saying that to your wife or your significant other at some point.
Yeah, right.
See how that goes over.
Hey, personal property, how's it going?
Right. Show me your teeth, honey. She's got a kiss like fire. She burns the lips right off of my face. So, that sounds like she needs some ointment or something. But, yeah, it's not a great one. It's cookie cutter. That's exactly how I would characterize it. You know, it's filler, you know?
Well, think about it. If this song is a Steel Panther song making fun of this song,
right?
They could put it on their record. You could put this on a Steel Panther record, and you'd laugh at it and say, yeah,
right.
They nailed it. They nailed it there. It's a parody of itself, so...
You know what, though? Like, I have to throw in my disclaimer here, too, because, dude, I'm a Kiss fan. Right, as are you.
Yeah.
You know, I get the hypocrisy, like, as a Kiss fan, you know, but I kind of want a little bit more from Def Leppard. Like you said, they're capable of better, you know. Yeah, I kind of enjoy the part where it says, adios, au revoir, vous y zen, goodbye. Like, it's neat how that rolls. It makes no sense in the song whatsoever, but just the way that rolls lyrically, I think is cool. But, yeah, not good. You can whistle like a wolf, or you can mess around. But let me tell you the secret of the sweet life. If you want to stay healthy, man, take my advice. You better hit the road, Jack, and don't come back. You could be king of the jungle, or you could swing in the rain. But you don't need no monkey, not my babe. Because I'm her Tarzan, and she's my Jane. Personal property.
Yeah, and property was such a poor choice of word for so many reasons, even including that it just doesn't sound good when you sing it, as is quite evident. So,
right. Hey, you know what? Maybe. I wonder if there's any third world countries where, like, men, you know, subjugate women that they think that's just a bit of an anthem for them.
Yeah. Yeah, you put on your burka, baby. Cover those ankles. So, moving on to the next song, Have You Ever Needed Someone So Bad, which, you know, the era of the power ballad, this to me, this is one of the most egregious examples of a zombie ballad, like a clone ballad. Fill in the blanks, right. You know, formulaic. We need one of those songs.
Yeah, it's not great.
No.
I would agree. This was, I just fall asleep right from the get-go. It's like a nap. Again, Def Leppard's not a ballad band for me, and this is... Was it Two Steps Behind was the next... Right, that's the Last Action Hero song?
Yeah.
There's already two missteps on this record and the ballads. Have You Ever Needed Someone and Tonight, you know? This is not good. I think I had much more than that. Sorry.
Yeah. And I always say I'm not anti-ballad. It's not that I dislike the song because it's a ballad, but you had a formula that there were so many ballads that were coming out that it's like they only existed to fill that spot that needed to be filled on the record. And so it started becoming a real problem with some of them because they were just so formulaic and obvious and just kind of insulting to your intelligence. At some point.
There you go, midnight promises again. Yeah. But the broken by the dawn. You wanna go faster every day, baby. But in the morning you'll be gone. I'm alone.
I feel bad for if any Def Leppard fans stumble upon your show and listen to, oh, check it out. I love Adrenalize. They've gotten to this point, you know, God bless you. But, you know, they're probably just cursing at us at this point. Fuck these guys. That was my wedding song.
Well, sorry. Sorry that was your wedding song.
Yeah, since gotten divorced, but yeah.
You didn't need them that bad.
So should we move on?
Yeah, moving on to I Wanna Touch You. The verse of this song was actually the chorus of a song that Joe had called High On You, I guess, and Rick Allen came up with the chorus. I wrote down that this song is on the level of a Kids Incorporated song.
Hey man, that's not fair. Kids Incorporated had some good songs.
I mean, it's not bad. It's not horrible, but you know, it's Kids Incorporated. I don't know what else. You know, it's about the level it's at, I think.
Right.
Apologies to Kids Incorporated.
Artica, nothing personal. Yeah, I think it's I Want to Touch You with a U, like Prince yeah. style. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that right there should be a sign. Yeah, like when you see that, that's not a Def Leppard thing.
Yeah, that's not a good sign. You're right.
Yeah. Till we stick it like glue. Like he rhymes you with glue. Isn't that clever? Because... Stick like glue, it cuts like a knife or burns like flame, whatever. Stuck like glue. I get high on you, I'm on fire over you. I like the, and I can't let you go. can't let you go. Like, that's cool. And sort of descends there, and then it comes. Yeah, big hooky chorus. I want to touch you. I like his ad-libs over that. Again, that's what I call a Def Leppardism, right? So the repetitive, I want to touch you, and then him singing meh, 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 or something over it, right?
Yeah.
I enjoy that dynamic, but yeah, pretty bland. This was the 7th single, by the way, in July 93.
Wow.
So. Did you ever hear any of these songs? None of these songs had legs.
No.
You know?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always come down to the quality of the song as to whether or not it's a hit, but I think with this album, it really, yeah, they just didn't have, the songs weren't good enough. I think Stand Up was good enough, but, you know, that was, what, the 5th single or something, so.
I want to say I put I Want to Touch You on a mixtape for a girl once.
It's not terrible. It's one of the better songs on the album, which, of course, that's not, you know, that's not a high compliment. Oh, this one, the better songs than Adrenalize. Yeah, but that's
right.
But yeah, it is. But it's also, I think, with different lyrics, it would be less cringe inducing and then maybe more listenable. But
yeah, maybe. You're very optimistic, BJ.
So the last song on the record, I loved it 5 years earlier when it came out. You know, it's I would just rather listen to the original version than the, you know, the re-recording for Adrenalize, Tear It Down. I don't really know why they put it on here. They just tacked it on the end, too. But I guess, you know, they only had 9 songs. I don't know. It's a great song. It's very simple. Yeah, it wouldn't really fit on Hysteria very well, but it doesn't really fit here so much either. I don't know why they put it on here. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. But
maybe they thought it deserved a better chance, but it wasn't a single, so,
right.
You know. I mean, B-side, maybe it wasn't released in every country. Maybe, you know, they wanted to get it on an album proper because they enjoyed it. It's, you know, arrangement-wise, it follows I Want to Touch You in terms of the chorus, right? So that... This is probably part of the why I'm getting turned off a bit. Although I like it, you know, it's got, you know, I Want to Touch You, and then Joe singing an ad-lib. Do we stick it like glue, right? And then repeats, I Want to Touch You, right? So same thing for Tear It Down. Tear It Down. It's got to be a battle. Tear It Down. Can't wait enough, right? It's the same structure, same song structure. Yeah, I enjoy the song, too. And I was aware that it was a B-side, but I didn't have that single, you know, and I didn't know the song. So, to me, this was my discovery of it, and I enjoy it here. And it's a good upbeat closer on the album. Every time I hear this, though, it's funny, because I always want to hear Queen had a song called Tear It Up. So every time I hear Def Leppard's Tear It Down, I want to then go listen to Queen Tear It Up for some reason.
I think I always loved it, but I know that, you know, as for a big fan of, like, Pyromania, and then when Hysteria came out and being kind of confused about it, and then you get this song on the single, and you're just so happy to have a more rockin' Def Leppard song, that I think, you know, my appreciation for the song is, a lot of it goes back to that, because it's a pretty simple song, there's not a lot going on, But I loved those Hysteria B-sides. For me, back then, you know, they were better than the album, because Ring of Fire was so great, too, and then they had Ride Into the Sun was on one of them.
As the song gets to the end, it, like, the pace picks up, right? It sort of goes out with a burst, a blast, you know, it doesn't trickle out, right? It sort of picks up the pace at the end. That seems to get more frenetic at the end of the song, which I like. I like them closing the album that way.
Ready,
Leopard Adrenaline is four stars.
4 stars out of 20, right? Yeah, I mean, what a massive flop it was, too. I mean, no hit song. There was no hit single. And, I mean, 3 million copies for Def Leppard after Hysteria is really a disaster.
That's a funny way to say it, right? Because, like, the expectations would be that it would be more, right? So I always think of, not that Adrenalize is their Tusk, right? But following rumors, you know, Fleetwood Mac had a lot of pressure to, you know,
yeah,
where's Tusk, where's the next album going to go, right? So in a way, like, it's impossible to capture lightning in a bottle twice like that, right? But, you know, so I wouldn't consider 3 million a flop, but, you know, did it meet expectations of the Def Leppard post Hysteria album? Probably not. But, you know, same thing, like I said, you wouldn't dump on Tusk through that, you know, looking at it through that same prism again. But, you know, so it's kind of unfair to look at Adrenalize in that way.
Well, but Tusk was a double album, and Tusk had Lindsey Buckingham, you know, being very eccentric, whereas Adrenalize is shorter, and I mean, it's pretty much continuing in the same vein, like you said, as the worst parts of Hysteria. But
Maybe it's this. It's like, yeah, so the worst parts of Hysteria. So maybe Tusk took rumors and just added way too much substance, whereas Adrenalize,
yeah,
Adrenalize did the opposite, took Hysteria and removed any remnants of substance. You know,
if Fleetwood Mac had come out with a single album that was much more in line with a you know, more logical follow up to Rumors, it probably would have been much more successful than Tusk, right?
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't consider 3 million a flop. It's just, you know, it's just following up Hysteria. That
Anti-Romania. I mean, when you're following up two of the biggest albums,
right,
ever at the time,
it's like Michael Jackson's Invincible, right? Like he had what, two or three, you know, those Thriller, Bad, all that stuff, Dangerous, and then here's Invincible, which is just a piece of crap. So,
well, and also, yeah, also you have to consider that every other band, every other hard rock band that was successful in the 80s, they were lucky to sell 3,000 copies in 92-93. So, yeah, from that point of view.
Yeah, true. I don't think Def Leppard ever really recovers from this period. Not for me. Maybe it's the way I look at them. But, you know, like I said, Craig and I saw them on this tour, and I remember enjoying it. I remember they played White Lightning, and I remember that was pretty cool. But, yeah, they didn't ever really... It wasn't just a lull. It was, you know, like, they didn't ever really reach another plateau after that. You know, they've been consistently a theater or smaller arena band. They never kind of recaptured Hysteria, if you will.
No. Well, I definitely like Slaying a lot more than Adrenalize. And also Euphoria is definitely better than Adrenalize, too. But yeah, we're going to talk about Slaying next week with Pat Francis, so that'll be fun. So, final verdict on Adrenalize. I don't know, what more can you say?
Yeah, kind of what I said, just in summary. Yeah, when I picked it up to listen to it again, because we were doing this episode, I enjoyed it on the first pass in a nostalgic way. Like, oh, check it out, I remember this song, it's a cool hook, right? And then the second time, maybe a little bit more. But then by like the fourth listen, I was like, yeah, I'm ready to not listen to this again. So that's kind of how I was at the time when it came out. You know, I wanted to like it. It was Def Leppard. They were hot, right? But it just didn't hold up after a pretty short time. It wasn't like it hung on for a while. It was, you know, I think I saw them in concert, and maybe that was almost the end of it for me. And I think I did pick up Slang at a point and Spin That once or twice and Euphoria, but it just never rekindled for me.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't get the impression that they tried very hard with this record. A lot of it seems, like I said, they pulled it out of half their ass. That's how a lot of it feels to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you listen to Hysteria, obviously, they tried really hard on that. And it just, I just don't get the same, feeling from this at all.
Right. Yeah, the business changed. They changed in a way. Just, yeah.
But as we talked about what they had gone through with Steve Clark and what they had gone through with Rick Allen and just everything that had happened, I don't know why they ended up with this, but it doesn't... Obviously, they didn't want to take any longer than they were already taking to get this thing done and put it out. And I think that's part of it, is they finally just had to put something out, even if
right.
it wasn't... Even if they hadn't done as much work on it or didn't... I mean, maybe they had writer's block. Maybe they just couldn't come up with stuff, and they just had to get a record out. That's kind of how it feels, really.
Yeah, and again, back to the stuff that's happening behind the scenes. If, you know, if you're, it'd be hard in those situations to be creative sometimes, right? You would think.
And they're missing Steve Clark's input, which, I mean, judging from this record, it must have been pretty. He must have had played a pretty huge role in the creative process, and that could be a big part of it. Even though he is a co-writer on a lot of the songs, you know, he wasn't there when they were making the record, so.
Yeah, maybe it throws it off balance, right? Maybe it was a combination of the dudes, and, you know, one of the ingredients gone, it changes the recipe, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, apparently they made this record without Steve Clark and without Mutt Lange, so that right there could show you why the quality dips so much from Hysteria, that could be a to play a big part in it, I guess.
I can't think of one, hey, that's on this record.
Yeah, right, because that's about Lang, right? Well, thanks a lot, Eric, for taking one for the team and doing Adrenalize with me.
It really was like, yeah, if you can't find anybody else, I'll do Adrenalize.
yeah, it was. Yeah.
So, well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Walk away if you want to. It's okay if you need to.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a song from Def Leppard's B-Sides and Outtakes compilation, Retroactive, that came out in between Adrenalize and the album that we're going to cover next week, Slang. A lot of cool stuff on this compilation. It's definitely well worth owning. I'm going to play a cover version they did of a song by Mick Ronson from his solo album Slaughter on 10th Avenue. I've actually already played the Mick Ronson original version of this song on one of the Vinyl Countdown episodes, but this is a great cover version of the song by Def Leppard. So this is Only After Dark from Retroactive. Till next time.
Be back.